This is the Political Economy Podcast. Complexity in an age of climate catastrophe, social injustice, and post-democracy. Hi, this is Zoltan Pogacar, and today we are looking at the China model, Political Meritocracy and Limits of Democracy by Daniel A. Bell, published by Princeton University Press in 2016. Daniel A. Bell is chair professor of the Schwarzman Scholar Program at Tsinghua University in Beijing and director of the Berggruen Institute of Philosophy and Culture. He was born in Montreal, educated at McGill and Oxford, has taught in Singapore and Hong Kong, and has held research fellowships at Princeton's University Center for Human Values and Stanford's Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences. It is an interesting and brave idea not to take it for granted that Western democracy is better than the Chinese political system, which they refer to as meritocracy. To be honest with ourselves, the data actually does not suggest the supremacy of the Western system. The Chinese and Singaporean closed systems have given these countries the most impressive growth story in human history. Singapore started off after World War II, not even a country. It was an impoverished, multi-ethnic British colony which had specialized in repairing ships. Most citizens could not read or write, and ethnic and religious tensions were the norm. In the space of two generations, per capita living standards in Singapore overtook the United States. There is ethnic and religious harmony, and the economy is highly knowledge intensive. Yet Singapore has never had democracy. It has always been a one-party state for most of its history, run by one man, Lee Kuan Yew, leading the country from poverty to prosperity. A similar story has unfolded in China. Before its reform and opening in the 80s, China had been an extremely poor country with mass starvation during the so-called Great Leap Forward, killing between 18 and 40 million people. Yet, from the 1990s, the new Chinese economic model has succeeded in lifting 800 million out of poverty. China is by now the global leader in several key technologies, from 5G communication to solar energy and e-cars, from high-speed trains to mobile phones. In the same time period, democracy has given America Donald Trump, and the drunkard offshore tax haven chief Jean-Claude Juncker became president of the European Commission. It gave the UK Boris Johnson and Brexit, effectively a civil war in the United States, and the collapse of several Eurozone economies. Economic growth in the West has been significantly slower in recent decades than in Asia, and inequalities have exploded. Simply looking at the data, therefore, we cannot state with confidence that democracy has what is called output legitimacy. Indeed, quite the opposite. Yet we in the West still take it for granted that our system is superior. The Chinese do not. Daniel Bell quotes meta-analysis of opinion polls taken in China, which have come to the conclusion that effectively all opinion surveys indicate overwhelming support, popular support for the regime. An obvious reaction is that perhaps respondents are somehow coerced into declaring their loyalty. Researchers have therefore devised methodologies to filter out this possibility. The results are still the same. The Chinese regime is popular. It provides opportunities for families to do better from year to year and from generation to generation. It has output legitimacy. While most people in other societies around the world experience angst and decline, the Chinese have enjoyed decades of optimism. Daniel Bell is critical of the shortcomings of democracy, But he is not apologetic of the Chinese model either, something he has often been accused of, most probably by people who have not read his work. In fact, he does speak openly about China's faults. You can find textual evidence of this, from the failings of Mao to Tiananmen to human rights, corruption, inequalities, etc. All of these are mentioned in the book explicitly. However, Daniel Bell has some understanding for why the Chinese population is constantly measured to be supportive of their regime, and why they are skeptical about democracy. The downsides of democracy. A very interesting opening part of the book is Bell's discussion of the downsides of democracy. The practice of choosing a country's top leaders by free and fair competitive elections has only had a relatively short history of less than a century in most countries. It seems too early to assume that this is the best system for all time. There are at least four main concerns. Number one, tyranny of the majority. Irrational and self-interested majorities acting through the democratic process can use their power to oppress minorities and enact bad policies. This can happen even if the majority is only marginal but is sustained. It can continue to suppress the minority. To be certain, the majority is not always the wisest. Bell brings examples of all the stupid ideas the majority of Americans believe in. 79% of them cannot identify their state senators. Most cannot identify congressional candidates even in election years. Only 44% believe that global warming is man-made, while 77% believe in aliens. Only 21% believe in evolution. Naturally, one could and should make the argument against Bell's point that the prerequisite for democracy is a well-educated middle class, such as what exists in Scandinavia, where the majority is well-informed and tends to trust science. The United States and other countries could also have created such an informed electorate had neoliberalism not underfinanced their extremely unequal educational systems. But Bell does have a point. He tells us to consider the following. In a dispute within a family or NGO or firm, would we believe that voting was the best way of solving a challenge? Or would we believe in the power of good arguments? Why would it be different at a societal scale? Number two, tyranny of the minority. A small group with economic power exerts disproportionate influence on the political process, either blocking change that is in the common interest, or lobbying for policies that benefit only their own partial interests. This is effectively the situation in most Western democracies, where oligarchs control the political process through the ownership of mass media, through political campaign financing, as well as blackmailing politicians with decisions about investment locations. In reality, policymaking takes place between elections, largely outside the glare of the media focus. That's when big business interests mobilize and pressure policymakers to influence the structure of private markets in their favor. It is as if spectators would believe they could influence outcomes by voting for the best teams, while in reality, it would all be decided by which team is the wealthiest. Many books have been written about this, but the problem apparently runs deeper than simply exposing this sad reality. Number three, the tyranny of the voting community. If there is a serious conflict of interest between the needs of voters and the needs of non-voters affected by the policies of government, such as future generations and foreigners, the former will always have priority. An obvious example is the measure with present-day benefits, but which aggravates global warming and climate change in the longer run. As Danielle Bell describes, the Chinese meritocratic system has an advantage of dealing with such issues. An example is Singapore's institution of a president with the power to veto attempts to enact policies that would harm the interests of future generations. Number four, the tyranny of competitive individualists. Electoral democracy can exacerbate rather than alleviate social conflict. A system based on consensus as a decision-making procedure can help to remedy this flow. There is a multitude of democracies around the world where political party competition has led to extreme polarization. The United States, the United Kingdom, Israel, Italy, and Hungary are just a few examples. In democracies in general, you rarely find political parties that rely on attractive policy proposals to win support. Social psychologists have found that the image of an enemy is far more effective, unfortunately, in mobilizing voters. It is not by accident that politicians rely on mutual demonization, claiming that if they themselves are not elected, the opposition will end democracy, introduce fascism or communism, serve foreign interests as opposed to national ones. Supporting the red team or the blue team in politics becomes in some ways less meaningful than supporting the Celtics or the Lakers. Bell quotes international value surveys which suggest that Asians prefer social harmony to political strife. So does the tradition of Confucianism. Even in Hong Kong, the most individualistic part of China, 55.3% of those surveyed in 2012 by the Chinese University of Hong Kong agreed that social harmony should be the main goal of development. Asian meritocracy. The Asian alternative to democracy is meritocracy. Singapore, China, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Taiwan were all authoritarian states during their economic miracles. Japan was not fully democratic either, with the Liberal Democratic Party governing uninterrupted from World War II all the way into the 1990s. Chinese leaders often say that theirs is such a large and complicated country that introducing a multi-party democracy today would result in exploding political antagonisms. These might not only be of a social or economic nature, but also based on regional, ethnic, and religious identity. Multi-party politicians would be financed by business groups and the mafia. If we consider modern Chinese history, these concerns appear to be justified. There are plenty of examples of regional warlords, a lack of central government, disintegration, mafia rivalry, and outright civil war. Potentially, China could go down the path of formerly democratic but chaotic and unstable states such as Iraq, Afghanistan, India, Pakistan, Ukraine, or worse. The West often complains about the lack of democracy in China, but there is certainly stability. Should multi-party democracy be introduced, the West would very likely be complaining about a massive lack of stability in China, which would threaten the entire Asian region and beyond. In his 1968 book, Political Order in Changing Societies, political scientist Samuel Huntington agrees. He controversially found that premature increases in political participation, including early elections, tended to destabilize fragile political systems in the developing world. Hence, a modernizing dictatorship that provides political order, rule of law, and the conditions for successful socio-economic development pave the way for the development of a wide educated middle class, which will in turn struggle and win itself a democracy. This is exactly what happened in South Korea and Taiwan, and to some degree in Japan and marginally in Hong Kong. However, it has never happened in Singapore. Is it going to happen in China? Danielle Bell asks. Another very pertinent question is, of course, why Asia tends to have modernizing dictatorships, while in other parts of the world, dictatorships usually lead to sustained underdevelopment. And so do nascent democracies, for that matter. The political economist Paul Collier has written an important book entitled The Bottom Billion, Why the Poorest Countries Are Failing and What Can Be Done About It, on the fate of democracy in poor, ethnically divided countries. So what sort of a political system does China have? The strange thing, Bell argues, is that hardly anyone in China thinks that the country should not one day become an elective democracy. Yet most people believe the time is not right yet, and it is dangerous to actually organize a political movement for this goal, as many have found out. China's system for the time being is one based on meritocracy. Bell outlines the numerous levels of governance from local through regional and provincial to the central level that aspiring Chinese politicians have to prove themselves at to get to the top. Only the very best students are accepted into the Communist Party, which Bell stresses is neither communist anymore nor really a party. It is more of an ideological parallel for the state, whose ideology is increasingly nationalism, Confucianism, and the Asian development state model. There is plenty of literature out there on this model. A key variant in the so-called varieties of capitalism approach to political economy. On the functioning of the Chinese Communist Party, it is worth reading The Party, The Secret World of China's Communist Rulers by Richard MacGregor. That book also explains how top Chinese capitalists are also co-opted into the party, the most famous example being Jack Ma, the founder of Alibaba. China has also reintroduced the national examinations for civil servants and public administrators, which dates back centuries into the Confucian past. In fact, it is the examination with the longest historical tradition anywhere in the world. Confucianism believes in the concept of government by honorable man, or shenxi. China's political system is meritocratic. No one makes it to the top who has not proved himself at numerous lower levels. Someone like Donald Trump or Boris Johnson would never be eligible for top office in China. In fact, most Chinese would be confident that someone like Xi Jinping is better qualified as a leader than actual Western presidents and prime ministers. This does not mean, of course, that all Western democratic leaders lack meritocratic credentials. Take the case of German Chancellor Angela Merkel. No matter where one stands politically, it is hard to question that she is qualified to lead. However, the Chinese public would prefer not to leave it to chance. They prefer a system that guarantees that all candidates are competent. If we think about it, no hospital, firm, or university would choose a top leader without necessary qualifications. It is strange, really, that we readily accept a formally unqualified person to head our political system in case he or she is elected by a majority on the basis of one person, one vote. China's political system is not one of dictatorial leadership seized by one man for a lifetime or even for generations in the form of a dynasty, like in many countries all over the world. Leaders are chosen collectively and are then replaced by new ones. Previous leaders can try and influence who follows them, but they do not determine the outcome. The most well-known case is 2012, when outgoing president Hu Jintao famously favored Li Keqiang as his successor, but it was Xi Jinping who was eventually selected based on an internal survey of national senior leaders. China is not the Soviet Union. The best party cadres are sent to study at top universities abroad. Corruption. The part of the book that leaves most questions unanswered is the one that deals with corruption. Usually, what tends to happen when there is a one-party, one-person rule anywhere in the world is that development is arrested by rampant corruption and embezzlement of public funds. In fact, this happens also in young democracies the world over. South America, Southern and Eastern Europe, and Africa are full of examples. Why is this not the case in Asia? China and South Korea did and do have high levels of corruption, and the families of Chinese political leaders tend to be super rich. Yet this does not seem to inhibit development. Transparency International ranks democratic countries such as Mexico, Turkey, India, or Indonesia as more corrupt than China. Authoritarian Singapore is virtually corruption-free. In Taiwan, the dictatorial Kuomintang state decreased corruption. This low level carried on in the democratic period also. Bell hints that the meritocratic ethic has something to do with it. All of these states choose extremely qualified people to lead them. There is an active and efficient fight against corruption. Yet Bell could say more about why this is successful. In many democratic states, not to speak of non-democratic ones, the central power squashes the anti-corruption agencies and NGOs and continues to rob the country. Why is this not the case in Asia? All in all, the China model is an interesting book. Most Westerners cherish their democratic vote on simple procedural grounds. It is fair. Yet simple procedural fairness will not be enough to sustain democracy in the longer run if the system does not deliver output legitimacy, if it does not guarantee fairer living conditions, good leaders, and a response to the climate crisis. After all, if we only wanted procedural fairness, we could rely on a coin flip to decide who is to hold office. The ancient Athenians did. You have been listening to the Political Economy podcast. For debates and feedback, find us on Facebook. If you'd like to donate to the show, please find us on Patreon. See you next time.